I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For many, being at church is comforting in times of upheaval, but a large part of preventing the spread of COVID-19 is avoiding large gatherings, which could include church services. Today, we visit with local faith leaders about the church's place in the midst of the new coronavirus, and we'll find out how some congregants are participating in worship from home. Then, a look at what U.S. Census officials call hard-to-count communities. There are about 60 of them in the Kansas City region. We'll ask how census workers are reaching out to residents there and learn why an accurate count is so important. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The coronavirus doesn't discriminate. Even houses of faith are affected. One big question heading into the weekend is how Kansas City churches will fare in the wake of this very difficult week when the virus seemed to take over the country. Will congregants even go to church or synagogue this weekend? Will Christian churches take part in Holy Communion or the passing of the peace? What about Sunday school for the kids? And what happens to coffee hour? The place of the church in the midst of coronavirus, that's our topic here. With us, Reverend Adam Hamilton is a senior pastor of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection in Leawood. He joins us via Skype this morning. Reverend Hamilton, always nice to have you. Good morning.
It's great to be with you, Steve. Thank you so much.
Dr. Linda Settles is the executive pastor at St. James United Methodist Church. Dr. Settles, good morning to you.
Thank you, Steve.
And also here's the Reverend Shannon Stites. She's the senior minister of the Community Christian Church. Reverend Stites, nice to have you too.
Good to see you.
Well, the church has endured a lot over the years, even over the centuries, Reverend Hamilton. Has there ever been anything quite like COVID-19?
You know, what I've been reading this week was about the what was called the Spanish flu around 1918, 1919. And of course, you know, millions died in that. And a lot of similarities. There were churches that were shut down. There were communities that asked people not to meet in larger groups. And so it's, you know, it's interesting. It's different in some ways, but some interesting parallels.
So the church has endured through similar difficulties in the past, is what you're saying.
Right, exactly. And you know, there was the debate about, do we have church services? Do we, you know, what? How do we go about ministering to people when, you know, when there's a fear of this virus going on? And actually going all the way, really throughout the history of the, you know, the Christian era, you have plagues or what was called pestilence that happened throughout the centuries. And what was interesting, especially in the early years of the Christian faith, where there were many people who were taking their sick and they were leaving them on the streets, and you found there were people of faith who were actually going out and helping them when others weren't helping their own family members. So in the early centuries, you know, this was part of what Christians were known for, were going out, you know, in essence, like the Marines, running towards the danger and not away from it. That's not always been the case, but that certainly was the case in many periods of time throughout history.
You know, Dr. Settles, given the level of confusion that Reverend Hamilton just referred to, I'm just curious how often the phones are ringing in your church offices these days and with members who have questions about what in the world's happening with their church this weekend.
It's been very busy.
I imagine.
Many people are wondering, are we still going to do the greeting? What are we going to do for communion and offering and everything? And are we even going to have worship? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, our office has been very busy. And so we have come up with some protocols that we are putting in place. And so now we have some clear and concrete answers as to how we're going to approach it and keeping people as safe as we can.
But just for the record, you are having services this weekend?
We are having services. We have two campuses. Two services at the Paseo campus and one at our Renaissance campus.
Okay. Reverend Stites, how about you? How often are your phones ringing these days?
We've been very busy. We have tried to use our social media platforms to really communicate to our community. We say we are one church in two states in eight counties, and so we're spread out throughout the metropolitan area. So we really rely on our social media platforms and in our internet presence, as well as for our folks who don't have those access to the internet or don't use those kind of platforms, trying to make sure that what we would call an old school prayer chain, you know, is up and running and checking on people and trying to communicate as well as we can. We were talking outside about folks who don't have internet access and the restrictions around some of that.
What questions do people have when they call your office?
One of the biggest questions our folks have is about communion. For our tradition in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, communion happens for us every time we gather. It happens every Sunday morning. And so how are we going to navigate that? How are we going to limit touches? And so that's been a big question for our folks is, what about communion? Because in our tradition, it's just almost not worship if we don't have communion. So.
You know, we're joined at our table today, Reverend Hamilton, by folks who have fairly large churches, and certainly that applies to the Church of the Resurrection. How did you and your staff approach this question of how to respond to the virus and whether to even consider canceling services this weekend?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we spent yesterday, we've been talking about this the last 2 weeks and probably before that even, but the last couple of weeks really looking at what do we have to do to create an environment that's as safe as possible for people when they gather for worship. And we have a large online presence, so we were encouraging people who were most vulnerable, those who were over 60 and those who were ill, to stay home and join us online because we didn't want them to put themselves at risk. We also then looked at how do we clean the building appropriately, and so we had our cleaning company come in, and we were actually prepared this weekend to clean every seat between all worship services, to sanitize all 3,500 seats. Wiping down handrails, you know, having plenty of antiseptic around. So all of those were things we were doing. We weren't going to pass the offering plate. We were going to have baskets in the back of the room and not pass our attendance notebooks. But on Thursday last night, actually, we made the final decision that we would not be having worship in person this weekend. We would have worship broadcast live on our online presence and platform. And part of that was around, I knew our most committed members would strive to be here regardless of their age or place in life. And we were recognizing that the concern wasn't, most of us aren't so afraid for ourselves, but the concern was what would happen if some of those folks took the coronavirus to their family members or friends, if it did spread, and it is going to spread. Really, in Kansas City, the experts are saying 30 to 60% of people are going to end up contracting it. Most people won't get sick from it, and it'll be very mild, but some people will, and it'll be, very serious. And so we agonized over the decision and finally said, we're going to decide not to have service live this weekend in person and instead encourage people to join us online.
Dr. Settles, how did your St. James United Methodist Church navigate that set of choices? You've made a different decision than what the Church of the Resurrection has. How did you go about that?
In a similar way, we got our team together and weighed pros and cons. And we talked about the communication that goes out. And basically, we let our congregants know that we understand these are trying times. And if you really don't feel comfortable coming, that's fine. But we also realize that in our community, everyone doesn't have access to the internet or social media. And so if you can't go to work, some can't go to work, some can't go to school, some can't go to sporting events or concert events, where can you go? We just decided to be open.
What about the danger of spreading the disease as a result?
Yeah, and so we're being as proactive as we possibly can, as any organization possibly can. We have a cleaning company that's coming to do a deep clean over the weekend at both campuses, disinfecting the nursery, the children's area. We did cancel Sunday school because of the closer proximity of folks.
Right.
And then we're going to encourage folks to spread out as they feel comfortable. We have a balcony and just do what we can to be as proactive.
So the theme here is, Reverend Stites, we're going to have cleaner churches as a result of the coronavirus. If nothing else happens, our churches are going to be cleaner.
That's right. It was funny yesterday. Our children and families minister was sort of at a loss. She needed something to do, and so she just felt the need to do. And so she gathered up with some of our facility staff every toy that she could gather, take it down, and ran everything through the deep sanitizing dishwasher. And, I mean, we're still cleaning in other ways.
How long has that been since that happened? I don't want to know.
No, yeah. She's pretty good at that.
She?
She's
okay.
Really great at that. So, yeah. But it was just one of those things of needing to feel like you need to do something.
And so do you think people are going to show up on Sunday?
I think we will. I think we won't have a whole lot. I think we have been pretty good about communicating with folks, not to, but I think we will see a significant reduction. And I hope that's true. And I think we will try to. We had our tech folks working on the live streaming yesterday to make sure everything was running in tip-top shape. I think we'll have some folks. I really don't think it will be our older folks. I think it will be some of folks of other age demographics. And we really agonized, like everybody else said. We really agonized over this decision about making the best decision. We did cancel one of our services that's in our smaller chapel, our early service, just because we did not feel we had the capacity to practice safe social distancing in that smaller space. And so, but the Frank Lloyd Wright space that we have as our larger sanctuary gives us the space to spread out to and give everybody a little more room. Also, we're not having our nursery open, not having Sunday school, like Linda said.
And so those are the adjustments you're making there.
Right. Yeah.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about how houses of faith, houses of worship are responding to the coronavirus. If you have questions, 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, Reverend Hamilton, all this strikes me as such an interesting moment. It's so contrary to the nature of the church, the soul of the church, to not have people gather together on a weekend like this when so many folks are uncomfortable, concerned, worried, even panicked about what's going on out there. How are you wrestling with that dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I felt most profoundly was the sermon this weekend is going to focus on fear and how we live unafraid in the face of these things. And we've got interviews with area health officials that we're going to be sharing. But, you know, this is one of those times you want everyone to gather, not to say, no, don't come in, we're going to be online. And, you know, in 29 years, we've never canceled service.
Wow.
I mean, we've had
12
inches of snow and we still had service. We told people stay home if you don't have four-wheel drive, but we're going to be here still doing this, even if there's only five people show up. And so it's total, you know, it's against everything that I feel like we should be doing to not, to not have services live this weekend. And I appreciate why the other two churches that you're speaking to are doing this. I respect them and I'm grateful for what they're doing. And yet, you know, we felt like, okay, we have the numbers of people who are showing up here and that, you know, we would have had, I don't know, who knows with the coronavirus, but without it, we would have had across our campuses, maybe 8,000 or 9,000 people in worship. And that's just a significant chunk of people. We didn't want to be spreading, you know, we didn't want to be taking something out of worship and taking it somewhere else. And I was at a conference just a couple of weeks ago, actually 3 weeks ago, an Episcopal conference. And, you know, I got earlier this week, I received a phone call that three of the priests there ended up with coronavirus. And, you know, nobody was even thinking about this at the time. And I was the keynote speaker there. We were, you know, people gathered from across the country. Now, you know, I got noticed, you're past the window. You're not, you know, you're fine. I checked in with the health department and everything was fine. But you realize just how easily something is spread. And if this can slow, you know, the whole idea of all the things we're doing, what the other churches are doing to mitigate what we're doing and just having online is to see if we can't slow the progression enough so that we don't find ourselves without enough hospital rooms to take care of the people who are sick. And the reality is that, you know, what I'm going to share this weekend is that, as you know, and as you've shared, you know, 80% of all people who contract this virus, they're going to see no symptoms at all. 20% are going to see symptoms. And yet, you know, a very small number of those are going to be very serious. And so, but when you add 9,000 people up on a weekend and you start talking about that one small percentage, it's still a lot of people, and we didn't want to contribute towards the spread of this.
You know, Reverend Hamilton, you have an online option, a worship online option on your website. To what extent do you think people will take advantage of that this weekend? And do you have any numbers based on surveys of people who are comfortable checking in that way?
Yeah. So almost everybody, last time I asked in worship on Sunday, I said, how many of you have worshiped online at least once in the last year? And the almost every person raised their hand. So
no
they all
kidding.
Are familiar with it. They use it well.
Yeah.
Typically on a weekend, we'll have 3,000 to 4,000 people who will worship online and joining us for the service. They sign in. And last weekend, the number doubled. And I think that doubling was from people across the country who weren't going to their own churches, but knew that we had an online platform to be able to worship. And we're anticipating, you know, we think this number, we're geared up so that we can have 15 to, 15,000 plus people online this weekend. Wow. We think most of our people will join that way.
Dr. Settles, how about online options? You mentioned before that some of your folks don't have computers, maybe don't have means for computers, but what role will online worship play at St. James?
We anticipate the same thing, that there will be less in-house and more worshiping online, and that is totally fine, and we've encouraged folks to do that as well.
What's lost when people worship online as opposed to being there in person?
Well, I'm going to speak from my experience for the African-American church. In times of chaos and crisis, we've always gone to the church.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we get our hope, our inspiration.
That's a
long tradition. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get the most up-to-date information, because typically the pastor is the one who is imparting that information, and Dr. Cleaver is very well versed on what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
To us, it's kind of countercultural to close. Not that we wouldn't if we were mandated to, or if, you know, the state of emergency dictated that we needed to. We certainly would comply with all regulations. And so that was our struggle. We certainly understand Church of the Resurrection and other churches that have made a different decision.
Right.
There's no judgment at all. We understand that. But that's what played into a part of our decision to at least be a presence there for whoever might. It might just be us and the staff and the pastor preaching to the pews, but that's okay.
Well, Reverend Stites at Community Christian Church, what role does online worship play at your house of worship, and what do you think is lost as a result?
I think what the biggest thing that is lost is especially for our folks who are elderly, who live alone, folks who may not have a whole lot of contact with neighbors. And we have, I think one of the things that is lost, we have a regular group that meets at least once a month who has Sunday after church lunch together, and they have potlucks there in the fellowship hall and things like that, of that person-to-person contact, those relationships. A lot of those folks are going to be more isolated. And so one of the ways that, not just with our online presence, but with our leadership circles of neighborhood circles, because we do cover the entire metro, of geographically trying to check in with one another.
Right.
Our elders of saying, okay, you know these folks, because we've broken the community down into smaller circles to be able to care for one another. And so that's been a gift for us in this time, to be able to say to some of our elders and our leadership, think about the folks in your circle, think about the folks in your neighborhood. And so it's really making us more intentional, not even on the online presence side, but more on the one-on-one, person-to-person relationship side of who do you need to call? Who do you need to check on? Who do you need to make a visit to, just to, you know, leave something on the doorstep or whatever it is, to really be more mindful. I think sometimes we take advantage of, oh, I'm always going to see the person who sits at the end of the pew with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so really thinking about, okay, who do I need to see? Who do I need to check on? What relationship do I need to nurture? And not take that for granted and really be intentional about it.
Dr. Settles, how will you handle Holy Communion? How will you handle the passing of the peace? I believe United Methodist churches go down both those roads. Yeah.
Right. Well, we have suspended the passing of the peace. Anything that cause personal contact.
No elbow bumps or anything, eh?
It's just hard. Again, speaking from my experience, the natural inclination is to go in for the hug.
Yeah, I get it.
You know?
I get it. So you're just going to suspend it all together.
We're just going to suspend it. Mm-hmm. And for communion, so far our plan is our ushers will wear gloves, and we will do the single serving, the all-inclusive one cup that has the wafer and the juice, and that will be handed to folks as they enter the sanctuary, so that they are the only one handling it.
So they're the only ones who will touch
that. Only ones who will open it and touch the wafer and open the juice and drink the juice. Then the used cup will be placed into the pew pocket, so that ushers at the end of service with gloves can come and receive, you know, throw them away.
Do you think some people will skip Holy Communion this time?
Well, we only have it on the first Sunday, so we still have a little bit to kind of get all of these other protocols in place and get folks acclimated to what we're doing and seeing how society starts to do
Reverend Stites, you're nodding your head as Dr. Settles is talking. You think
some
folks
might... take communion every week.
Okay.
We take communion every time we gather. And I know we had people who, because we are doing it where people come forward and I hand, or one of our other clergy hands people a piece of bread. We'll be wearing gloves to do that. And we will only be doing bread. We won't be doing cup at all. And we did have people skip last week. We've just invited folks as they come forward that we'll offer them a blessing. A personal blessing if they choose not to receive the elements.
Right. Reverend Hamilton, I know churches don't exist for money, but they that remains important nonetheless. What about the idea that if people aren't coming in the door, like they won't be this weekend at Church of the Resurrection, that they may not be keeping up with their pledges and their promises of financial support?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern for, you know, it's a concern for churches. It's a concern for any organization where people are not going to be showing up. You know, many of our folks, I think 50 or 60% already include this in their electronic. Yeah, they give electronically. So they, you know, that's a regular part of their giving. And it's something that they're not putting something in the plate. In fact, increasingly, fewer and fewer people are putting money in the plate. People don't use checks anymore, and they don't carry cash with them. So people use their phones and other means.
Right.
So folks already, when they're coming to church, are often using their phones, or they've already, you know, filled out an automatic giving, you know, created an automatic giving account. So, but it is going to affect us. And, you know, we know that that's part of the cost of this. And we just recognize, you know, we don't know how long this is going to last, but that will be a cost, and we're going to have to tighten our belts. And what we're really hoping is to make sure that that doesn't impact our mission and our ministry outside in the community. But you know, we feel like it was still the right thing to do. But we're, you know, there's going to be a cost to it. There's no question about it.
Reverend Hamilton,
I
can't
really at every church, because even the churches that stay open, I think probably both of our pastors who are on the panel here, you know, are recognizing that there'll be less and less people in the pews.
Yes.
Even if they're open.
Reverend Hamilton, I can't help but wonder about small churches across the country that are very different from yours, and the impact on those churches might be even more profound.
Yeah, I think so. I think people who use checks, who still write checks or give cash, tend to be older adults. And so if you're in a smaller congregation, and older adults are most at risk with the coronavirus, so those over 60, which are, I don't consider older adults, but people who are 60 and up, they are most at risk. And so those are the folks who also might be staying home. But I'll tell you this, though, is our most committed members who are, you know, those who are over 50 really in our congregation, although we've got a lot of really committed young people too, they tend to, when they come back to church, if they miss because they're sick, I mean, this is a part of their faith commitment. It's really not even to the church. It's really to God. And so most of those people end up finding some way to give no matter what. And I think that'll be true with you know, most of the most committed people across churches and religious communities.
Dr. Settles, what about at St. James?
I would say the same thing. You know, a lot of folks are just committed to giving, period. And so if they don't attend in person, they will either use text to give or, you know, some electronic form, go to our website and give. And those who do write checks, or we still have some that give by cash.
Right.
We have also informed them that the church office will be open during the week, or they can mail a check in. But I agree with Pastor Hamilton that many of the committed members, they just give. And even if they've missed on vacation or whatever,
They
come back and they will make that up.
You know, Reverend Stites, I'm sure that each of you has a lot of elderly members in your congregations. In the past, maybe you've gone to visit them, I'm thinking, you know, in their homes or in nursing homes. How will you approach your most senior members at a precarious time like this?
Leading always first with a phone call, I think, more than anything. I take special personal precautions because I have a spouse who has a compromised immune system due to medication that he takes for a chronic health condition. So I'm especially aware just on my own personal level of that and being mindful. But I really believe that just checking in via phone, we even with our older folks, a lot of our older folks still do email. And so we can email them. We've worked really hard as we moved to our online platform. One of the reasons when we really upgraded our live streaming last year was in part because we do have so many older folks, and because we do live all over the city, that making sure those folks knew how to access the online services and to be able to access the live stream on Sunday mornings, so that when the weather's bad in the winter or when the flu in the winter especially, they can still have access to that. And so some of those really are some of our older folks actually rely on that, not just at this time, but at all sorts of times of the year.
But so the idea of personal visits and going into their homes or nursing homes appears to be out.
I think most of the nursing homes are restricting access anyway. So I think for the, as you were saying earlier at the top of the hour with the case in Wyandotte County, that someone from the outside brought that in. I just don't think that's a responsible way to let those healthcare professionals in those facilities take care of those folks.
Yeah, you doing the same thing, Dr. Settles?
Yes, we are. And we're going to do more phone visitations as opposed to in person.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm wondering, Reverend Stites, about your message this weekend. Reverend Hamilton talked a little bit about what he's going to be talking about. You know, again, folks are nervous, folks are anxious. Yeah. What's going to be, where are you heading this weekend? Or maybe I'm asking you
That's a great question, because I started upending that with our clergy staff yesterday of rewriting that about what that's going to look like, just to try to address, and just exactly what Reverend Hamilton said about fear. And about, we're a place that we always talk about how you don't have to check your brain at the door when you come in, and that we're a place that always tries to balance faith and reason and heart and head and so scripture and science. And so trying to really think about how that's going to work. But call me on Monday and maybe I'll have a better answer for you as to where I end up. Because I started reworking that yesterday about 5:30 after we got all the other details sorted out, sort of the really practical details logistically as to how we were going to navigate things. So I'm going back and reworking a lot of what, which I think a lot of clergy folks are probably spending their Friday and Saturday reworking their sermons for Sunday morning.
Reverend Hamilton, there's a long tradition in the Christian church, and I think in every single house of worship in the country, that no pastor finishes a sermon before midnight on Saturday night. Am I right about that?
I have a 5 o'clock Saturday night service, so mine is done in 5 minutes till 5 p.m.
Yeah.
You got to be on top of that thing, eh? Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank our ministers for coming in and talking about the impact of coronavirus on their houses of worship. The Reverend Adam Hamilton joined us via Skype. He's with the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection in Leawood. Dr. Linda Settles is executive pastor at St. James United Methodist Church, and the Reverend Shanna Stites is senior minister of the Community Christian Church. Thank you all very much. Good luck in the weeks ahead. Okay, we'll
be
checking
in
with y'all. Yeah. After a short break, when we come back, we're going to talk about the census and this challenge of counting difficult-to-count communities. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Starting next week, we're going to do something different here. Up to Date and Central Standard are joining forces to bring you a joint program at 9 o'clock each weekday morning instead of our usual time at 11. We're going to be focusing on special coverage of the coronavirus in Kansas City. You can join Gina Kaufman and I here at 9 o'clock on Monday morning and each day next week and for the foreseeable future for a joint project here on focusing on the coronavirus. Well, when it comes to the once-a-decade census, every person counts. Maybe even as little as 1% of the population could cost the Kansas City area tens of millions of dollars. It could also mean a lot more kids showing up for school than officials anticipated, leading to all manner of problems in the classroom. But there's no doubt that some communities are tougher to count than others. In fact, something's been created called the hard-to-count map, and these days it's comprised of about 20% of the nation's 7,200 census tracts. The Kansas City area has 20 hard-to-count tracts on the Kansas side and 42 more on the Missouri side. Each tract includes about 4,000 people. Now, a conversation about why some communities are hard to count, the challenges of reaching these communities, and the importance of an accurate census count. With us are Jenny Garman. She's a legal and government information specialist for the Kansas City Public Library, where she leads the 2020 census initiative. Jenny, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Patrick Miller is also joining us this morning from Lawrence. He's a political scientist at the University of Kansas. Patrick, always a nice day of you, too. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Patrick, I'll start with you. Why do we even have a census in this country? What's the point?
Well, it's mandated in the Constitution that we'll have an enumeration of all persons living in the United States. We've had it since 1790, I believe. And the primary purpose, as it was originally envisioned, was representation in Congress. And that was an era when we didn't have a lot of federal programs like we have now that lead to a lot of money going out to states and localities based on census numbers. So that's really the origin, to give states representation in Congress, which is another big implication of it.
So we've been doing this, you're saying, for roughly 240 years. This is nothing new.
No, nothing new. The way that the census is written and the way it's implemented will often change every 10 years. And the Census Bureau puts a lot of effort into pilot testing and experimenting new innovations with the census process. But yes, this has been happening as the census as a count has been happening for over 200 years.
Yeah. Well, Jenny, there's this huge concern about making sure we can get an accurate count of making sure that all individuals finally get counted in this 2020 census. Why is that such a big deal?
It's such a big deal because in 2010, when we had the census, Missouri, because of an undercount, lost a representative. And while the federal government allocated about $16.5 billion to Missouri, the Missouri Health Foundation the Missouri Foundation for Health has estimated that we lost out on about $79 billion that could have come to Missouri.
Just because we didn't count everybody who lived in the state of Missouri, you're saying?
We were undercounted, and that's exactly why. That's what happened.
Yeah. You say that Kansas City, again, paid a big price here after the census because there was this failure to get an accurate count. What else was lost here because we didn't count everybody?
That representative, and also if we were to have an undercount like that again, Jackson County would lose about $20.5 million per year in federal funding.
So over the course of a decade, that adds up to quite a bit of money.
It's too much money, and it's that we don't need to lose out on. We just need to make sure we can communicate that it is easy to respond to the census, that it is safe to respond to the census, and that it's really, really important. It's not just about the money, not just about representation. It's about making sure everyone counts.
How did we manage to fall so short in our count? How can that happen? To a lot of people listening, it doesn't seem to be that complicated to go out and do a head count of how many folks are living anywhere.
What matters is the self-response. How many, and it's something that the Census Bureau, of course, will be very closely tracking this year with this census. But it can be all sorts of reasons why people are undercounted. Young children, for example, 10 years ago were the most undercounted population.
Huh.
And that's something.
Why would that be?
Because a lot of people don't understand. They see maybe perhaps the baby, and they say, oh, but doesn't really. Do we really count the baby? Or where do I count this baby? Because the grandparents take care, or they're in different custody arrangements, and nobody's sure where to count the young ones. But it's really crucial that we get the word out if you have a baby who's less than a year old, you just please count that baby.
Right.
But the age is zero.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Patrick, this notion that the census is so closely tied to the revenue for a county like Jackson County, home to Kansas City, I bet that's lost on a lot of people. Do you think?
I think it absolutely is. I mean, I think that people, you know, we hear oftentimes, that I think a lot of people have a sense that there is money attached to it. But the absolute numbers in that, I think, are often lost on people. You know, one way to think of this is that in our metro area here, every household is worth roughly $5,000 to $6,000 in terms of monies coming to the state and local governments simply because those individuals exist. In some parts of the country, that can be as low as $2,000. Some places as high as $7,000.
Huh. Interesting
year
idea.
Household. And if you think of that, you know, if a household fails to respond to this, then over the course of a decade, that might be $50,000 to $60,000. For a lot of programs that actually matter to a lot of people, if you look at federal budgets for much of the last decade, we're talking somewhere in the range of $600 to $700 billion in federal program money spread over almost 150 federal programs that are doling money out to states and localities based on these census numbers. And this includes things like highway funding, part of Medicare reimbursements, school lunch and school breakfast programs, mm-hmm. temporary aid to needy families, SNAP, Section 8 housing, special education grants, crime victim assistance programs. A lot of things that impact people in our communities here are going to be shortchanged if households don't respond to this.
So what you're saying is that Kansas City is hardly the only city in the country that fell into the undercount trap.
Oh, absolutely. You know, geographically, because of where harder-to-count populations, and, you know, when we talk about harder-to-count populations, we're talking about younger people generally, but especially younger children. We're talking about minorities. We're talking about poorer Americans of all races. Those populations do tend to be more urban. So the undercounts that we do have do tend to be concentrated in more urban to suburban communities than necessarily rural communities. But to be sure, there are a lot of rural communities in America. You know, Southwest Kansas, for example,
right,
which has a heavy minority population, that can also be disproportionately affected by this.
Okay, so Jenny, give us a sense of what is being done this time to ensure that we get a complete and accurate count and we don't do this undercount thing again.
Mid-America Regional Council stood up a regional complete count committee over a year ago to prepare our region to really galvanize efforts to get that complete count. They've done a marvelous job bringing in all sorts of organizations, nonprofits that would be able to be trusted voices with typically undercounted or hard-to-count populations.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great effort, and I'm really proud to be a part of that.
Is it a bigger effort than we've seen in the past? Because it seems like every 10 years you hear about this undercount concern. Is it possible to lick the problem once and for all through a harder effort?
I think with this united effort, with this we're also seeing and the importance of bridging the digital divide, because the online response is being highlighted very, very strongly by the Census Bureau, especially given COVID-19 concerns. And so self-response, whether it's online or over the phone or by mail, is something that's very strongly urged. But
online responses different? Have we had that in the past?
There's a stronger, I think that there was the opportunity to do that in 2010, but
It's a bigger deal this time.
The Census Bureau is really hoping that most people will be able to respond online. And that's why that united effort and getting the word out about where you can go to respond online if you don't have access to a computer or if you don't have access to the internet has been such a central focus of the Complete Count Committee.
You know, Patrick, we know there are a lot of hard-to-count parts of our country, as we've talked about here. The City University of New York has developed this hard-to-count map that determined that roughly 15,000 of the country's 72,000 census tracts qualify as hard-to-count. A tract, again, has about 4,000 inhabitants. What makes a tract hard-to-count?
Well, I think there are two things. One, if we think about individuals and just their propensity to answer surveys, because the census is really a survey, your willingness to answer a survey is not evenly distributed across the population. And a lot of these harder-to-count populations that we talk about are also, you know, less socially trusting, less trusting of government, of commercial survey takers. It's a lot of the same dynamic that goes into getting a representative sample in a survey, and that a lot of people just don't want to give out personal information. They don't really know what the survey or the census is about. There's
right.
not much trust there. They're busy. The other part of it is also the kinds of housing units that the census is dealing with. So if you think about how the census is logistically done, the census is actually surveying housing units rather than individuals. So the survey is going out to an address, and they're trying to count people at that address. And there's a lot of effort that goes in on the part of the census for enumerating housing units in the years leading up to the census. That can be especially complicated if we're talking about college dormitories or college mailing addresses, senior citizen homes, apartment dwellings. It's harder to stand on a curb and see each address and map that with satellite mapping, as the census often does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an element of it as well. It's not often obvious in some of these harder to count tracts what exactly the unique dwellings are.
Right, right, right. You know, Jenny, the Kansas City region, I've mentioned this, has about 60 hard-to-count tracts. Do we know where they are?
They're all around us.
All around us?
They're all around us, but with the, whether going to the MARC website or using the hard-to-count maps on the Census Bureau, it's a matter of knowing where they are, and MARC has done a really super job of identifying the hard-to-count tracts, like you've mentioned, and then really engaging people near those tracks, near those locations, to say, we need all hands on deck.
I was going to say, will more workers flood the zone, if you will, and go into these hard-to-track areas so that there's a better attempt at making sure we get a full count?
It helps set our priorities, and I think that's important. I know within our library district, we've been able to identify areas that we really want to bring more focus to. But the Census Bureau also will be monitoring response rates. And if they see a lower response rate in a particular area, they will send a mobile questionnaire assistance center where you have Census Bureau employees there in person who can help people fill out the questionnaire if the barrier is, I don't understand, or I don't know what this question means.
What was the name of that emergency squad?
It's called Mobile Questionnaire Assistance Centers.
Mobile Questionnaire Assistance Centers. That's kind of a mouthful.
It is a mouthful. It is a mouthful. And it's what I would really want to emphasize is that we have community partners who are establishing questionnaire assistance centers like the library and other community organizations. And anyone at one of those partner-led questionnaire assistance centers cannot fill out the census questionnaire for anyone.
Right.
You have to wait for a Census Bureau employee in order to have someone fill it out for you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking this morning about the census, the once-a-decade census, in these hard-to-count areas of our metro area, and the consequence for the census when folks aren't counted as they should be. I'm joined here by a couple of terrific experts. Jenny Garman is with the Kansas City Public Library. Patrick Miller, a political scientist over at KU. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Patrick, do you know where some other hard to count areas are in Kansas? As you look at the state map, what other sites pop up to you?
Well, we definitely see them around colleges for sure.
Why is that?
Here in Lawrence, college students may be answering that. Well, most of them are answering the census for the first time. A lot of them are transitional in terms of where they're living in town, or they have the residence at the university and then also with their parents, and they're not sure who should be answering that, where they should be getting counted. It's also harder to go into a university environment and necessarily get access to dorms, get access to the students,
right.
if you're an in-person census taker.
Where are those students, Patrick? Where are those students counted? Are they counted in their dormitory residence, or are they counted where their parents live?
Well, there's a degree of choice in that. When I answered the census myself in college for the first time, I got the mailer at my university mailing address at William & Mary, and I answered it there, and I counted myself there, and my parents didn't count me at home. But someone who was in a situation like me, they could have easily been counted at home if their parents had chosen to do that. We certainly don't want a double count of those individuals. But the guidelines aren't exactly clear because, again, the census is trying to count residence units and not necessarily the people who are in those units. So when they send that mailer out, they don't really know that per se if this is a student who also has part-time residence at home or if this is where they're really living most of the time. So that can be a complicated thing.
Jenny, what about somebody who's here illegally? How are they counted?
I'm glad you bring that up, because one of the things that I would want to say very, very loudly and clearly is that there is no citizenship question on the census questionnaire. And what that means is that we are in the business of counting every human being who was in the United States on April 1st.
But still, those who are here illegally will be nervous about this.
They may be nervous about that, and I hope that the idea of being counted and the idea of being represented and the idea of getting the federal funds into the community would override that fear.
Right. Dina, I'm sorry, from Belton. Dina, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was, you seem to identify that people feel like the questionnaire is invasive. Why do we have to give so much personal information? Like, why, if it's a headcount, why do you need names?
Why so much personal information there, Jenny?
I think what I would share with that is that the names are part of it. Patrick was talking about not having a double count and making sure that there is an understanding of where people are and who they are, so that if there happens to be a college student who lives in a dormitory but then is also counted at home by mistake, that there are formulas that the Census Bureau will have that will make sure that there isn't a double count of that person.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd also say, too, that the Census Bureau responses are protected for 72 years. In a couple of years, we'll have 1950s census responses. And a lot of this is used to in genealogy research. And if you don't have the names, how do you do your genealogy research?
Okay. Dina, I hope that helps. Let's go to Tom from Lenexa. Tom, you're on the show.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, the Trump administration had talked about adding a citizenship question, and they ultimately that got struck down. I was just wondering if there was any lingering trust issues associated with that.
Trust issues associated with the citizenship question, Jenny.
I think that because there, and that's another reason for me to say very loud and very clearly, there is no citizenship question on the census questionnaire, and so I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to say that one more time. But I agree with you. I think that there is lingering distrust. There is a fear about it. So if we could share with people who might be afraid to answer the census that their answers are protected by Title 13, it would take an act of Congress for the Census Bureau to divulge any personal information to anyone.
Yeah.
So I've talked with folks who've been Census Bureau responders where they come and they knock on the door or where they interact with people as they're filling out the census. They take a lifetime oath to protect your personal information.
Yeah.
And if they don't abide by that oath, it's $250,000 fine.
Wow.
And 5 years in federal prison.
Rochelle, you're on Up to Date. Rochelle, good morning.
Good morning. My mom is in a nursing home. Everything for her comes to my house. Do I count her as mine in my house in my census, or is she separate?
What I would say in response to that, based on conversations I've had with our great Census Bureau partnership specialists, is that nursing homes fall under the Census Bureau's group housing operation. So they would work with the administrator of that nursing home to make sure that all the residents there are counted.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So, Rochelle, thank you very much. Well, good conversation here about the challenges of conducting the census in hard-to-count communities, important stuff. I want to thank Jenny Garman again with the Kansas City Public Library. She heads the library's 2020 Census Initiative. Jenny, nice to have you. Thanks for the good information.
Thank you.
Patrick Miller joined us once again. He's a political scientist over at KU. Patrick, always appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next week, something special here at KCUR. Central Standard and Up to Date are joining forces for a new program at 9 o'clock on Mondays during this tensious time during the coronavirus situation, to bring you updated information about what's going on in our region about the virus and how you can respond. So 9 o'clock every morning beginning next Monday for the foreseeable future, a combined show, Up to Date and Central Standard coming together. You can join us for that, and as always, go to kcur.org/up-to-date to hear previous episodes of our show. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcurupto-date. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scheer, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.